It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dan Becker, President of Georgia Right to Life and the founder and president of the National Personhood Alliance. Under Becker's leadership, Georgia has become the national vanguard in the personhood movement. Becker's clear, concise, and compelling defense of life is seen in his recent book, Personhood, A Pragmatic Guide to Pro-Life Victory in the 21st Century and the Return to First Principles in Politics. His topic, Bringing the Pro-Life Movement into the 21st Century.
Thank you, Gordon. It's a privilege to be back here this year. I wasn't sure about my reception last year, but evidently we're good. Molly Smith is leading a charge for revival. Now, I'm from the Deep South, and I speak in revivalist terms. She is leading a revival in this nation, along with her, Denise Leopold and Paula and all the various leaders here in Ohio. So proud of the stand that they are taking that's making a difference nationally. And it's not just nationally. It's having an impact internationally. Personhood, and if we could go ahead and cue up the overhead there. Personhood Alliance is a new national organization, one of a handful who have as their foundation a faith-based approach to pro-life education, political action, and legislation. Let me say that again. There are not many national pro-life groups who are faith-based. We believe that the doctrine of Imago Dei, as we see in Genesis 1:27, where God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, male and female created he them, in the image of God created he them." The doctrine of Imago Dei has been the rallying cry of the church universal for 2,000 years. It wasn't a philosophy that took over the Roman Empire and the Roman culture. It was not a philosophy that took over the Germanic tribes who sacrificed children underneath the fir trees that we call Christmas trees. It wasn't a philosophy or a political strategy or even a judicial objective that took over the Celtic tribes in the UK. It was missionaries with the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel of life being carried and embodied in the Imago Dei that transforms cultures. And we are not ashamed of the fact that we have a biblical worldview approach. As Wesley Smith was talking about this morning, I am going to be talking on utilitarianism today, introducing that concept philosophically. We don't run from the philosophical discussions. Wherever the enemy is attacking, that's where we show up. That is where the church should be, is at the forefront, not following along behind. Now, I have to speak frankly, and I want to do this with as much love and compassion as I can towards those who disagree with that position. We believe that that is the only thing in this dark age that is going to propel us successfully into the hearts and minds, changing hearts and minds of individuals who will then change the culture, who will then elect the right politicians, who will then pass protective legislation. We do not allow the tail to wag the dog. Our objective is legal protection. But you don't begin there. You begin educating the culture. And we have to have a relevant message, a cultural message, which we can restore the sanctity of life and human dignity. And we would add marriage between a man and a woman. So our pro-life organization, Personhood Alliance, is a little over 120 days old. And I had the privilege when it was just a month old, of being invited by Morton Blackwell's Leadership Institute to be the keynote speaker in The Hague, Netherlands, for an international symposium of pro-life speakers from around the world. And as I delivered the keynote message there on personhood, the response was overwhelming. This is the largest pro-life gathering in the Netherlands in their history, and we have someone here who was there when there were only 12 people 20 years ago. And today, there are thousands upon thousands in the darkest pro-life country in Western culture, taking a stand for Christ, taking a stand for the gospel of life, against the culture of death, and everywhere that it raises its head. The response from the international community was, as I said, overwhelming. It amazed me, because they said to me, why have we not heard of personhood? Why is this a new term? Why are we talking about it now for the first time? The delegate from Israel came up to me, Tony Sperandeo, and he said, like Saul, a completed Jew, a leading evangelical pastor there in the nation of Israel, he said, my people, the Jews, understand the denial of personhood from the Holocaust. And my Palestinian Christians in my congregation understand it from the standpoint that they're being treated as a second-class citizen in our own country. This is the message that I believe the Lord is bringing to my country, and I want you to come and share this in Jerusalem in November. So, Lord willing, we are going to be, all of us, and I do want to say that Molly has agreed to serve, and you may have seen the notice, as the president of our National Personhood Alliance Educational Trust Fund, the 501c3, the educational arm. And we so much appreciate Molly's service and representation. Beautiful city, beautiful, quaint German countryside town along the banks of the Rhine River by the name of Hadamar, Germany. One of the things as I went to the symposium in The Hague was that I requested a side trip to this village. History, world history changed as a result of what took place in this town, this small town, nestled in the foothills of the Rhine Valley. Now, I want you to focus on that church that is there prominently on the hill. And I want, for the sake of this backstory that I'm going to share with you, I want you to view that as the church universal. It's all churches. It's no different in the village of Hadamar than anywhere else that we encounter in our towns and cities. It is a microcosm, and I'm going to take you back to what happened. The reason I found out afterwards that the timing of my presentation was so critical is that this is the 70th anniversary of the Allied liberation from the Nazis, and they're celebrating it all over Europe right now. And so the backstory of this little town in Hadamar captured their attention, and the struggle that we are facing here in the United States and elsewhere with a culture of death. Now, how many of you were here last year for my Ideas Have Consequences session? Can anybody tell me what the two terms that will come to dominate public policy in the 21st century were? Transhumanism and eugenics. One of only three people that picked that up. Transhumanism and eugenics are all over the place. Wesley and I were talking last night, and he said, they're everywhere. They're interspersed with Peter Singer's crowd of PETA, the animal rights folks. What are transhumanists doing with the animal rights crowd? It's the same philosophy, different expression in different ways. This is why I'm involved. This is 23 of my 26 grandchildren, which is not bad for a Southern Baptist, is it, Gordon? And they're growing. And I am fearful for my country, as Thomas Jefferson said. I am fearful that the justice of God cannot sleep forever. I mean, as James Dobson said, he will have to apologize, God will, to Sodom and Gomorrah if we are allowed to go unchallenged with the unrighteousness that has been allowed in our time. And it's for the sake of the next and coming generation that I feel the urgency to communicate that we must act differently. We have a saying in Georgia, if you always do what you always done, then you always get what you always got. Nothing new under the sun. It's been 42 years, and we have a partial birth abortion ban to show in the way of protective legislation. It doesn't save a single life. We've got to rethink our approach to the sanctity of life. Our goal, as Wesley said, is not to save babies. It's to faithfully stand where the church has stood for all time against the culture of death and for the sanctity of life and human dignity across the board. Because in the 21st century, the battlegrounds are expanding. We can no longer afford to just be anti-abortion. Wesley said it, I amend it, and you know, I'm saying it again. You'll probably hear it again before the time is over. Okay, I'm going to introduce this new concept that I said. This is another idea whose consequence can be traced back in history. Utilitarianism, it's a big word, it's not meant to cross your eyes. What we do is we use the terms the other side are using. They admit to this. This is not labeling them or in any way denigrating their position. They're proud of it. What is utilitarianism? It goes back to the early 1800s, a gentleman by the name of Jeremy Bentham, and you've heard it said, the greatest good for the greatest number. What is the basis of right and wrong? What is the moral compass for our nation? Well, it's the greatest good for the greatest number. Sounds good. I mean, that sounds very Hollywoodish, and they certainly have got entertainment and movies that reinforce this kind of concept. Jeremy Bentham had a disciple by the name of John Stuart Mill in the 1850s. He said, actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness. That's what Wesley was talking about this morning, the happiness principle. Can we have an example of that? We don't have to go any further than what he said this morning was gentleman by the name of Peter Singer. If the parents want the newborn, it's wrong to kill the baby because the act deprives them of happiness. On the other hand, killing a defective newborn is not morally equivalent to killing a person. And this is one of the things that Wesley and I have had a lot of discussion on. I do believe that human exceptionalism is the centerpiece of a philosophical approach to the issue of the sanctity of life. But what gives humans exceptionalness is the fact that we're created in the image of God. And so we are unashamed in the marketplace of ideas. And I went and met with Peter Singer about a year ago, and I'll be sharing some of that a little bit later. Wanted to know if the man really believed this or if this is a myth that we have demonized him with unrightly. And you may be surprised. Personhood beyond the human. Peter Singer is talking about personhood. They're doing seminars on personhood. The other side, transhumanists and eugenics, are talking about personhood, and they are seeking to define it as something other than the sanctity of life as found in the Imago Dei passage that has informed the church for all time. So we must do the same. And as a national organization that has explicit implications in changing the way that we strategize about education, politics, and legislation. And we have definitely broken ranks with the national groups on this. In Georgia, we had a 15-year test run of concept, proof of concept, and it worked amazingly well. And that's what we're going to be showing in the political track tomorrow morning, 10:30, if you want to come and catch that. The actual things that we changed to impact the political scenario in a state that was as cosmopolitan as Florida. We're not deep south. Over half the voters in Georgia live in Atlanta, and we're the largest gay and lesbian community east of the Rockies, even bigger than New York City. So we have our challenges. Can we make this stick? And that was the question that we addressed. You remember Wesley, once again, stole my thunder this morning, but he said the so what quote. Well, here's the so what quote from Mary Williams of Salon Magazine, a liberal magazine. So what if abortion ends a life? The fetus is indeed a human life, a life worth sacrificing. Now, when I read that in 2013, I was in the midst of lobbying that whole slew of pro-life bills in North Dakota that set pro-life history. More pro-life bills of greater depth were passed in one session than in the history of the pro-life movement up in North Dakota. It wasn't just a personhood amendment. It was heartbeat. It was fetal pain. It was, I mean, they did everything. There wasn't a pro-life bill they didn't like. And she came out with this statement as I was testifying in front of a committee, and it just sent goosebumps up and down my spine. Never since 1973, when I got involved in the movement through Francis Schaeffer, Dr. Francis Schaeffer, have I seen the admission that was made in this way. The fetus is indeed a life worth sacrificing. All life is not equal. This is not Germany. This is not Russia. This is not North Korea. This is the United States of America. We have got to understand that the challenges facing us as pro-lifers in the public policy realm and elsewhere are ratcheting to a record level, and we can change things, but we have to act soon. Otherwise, it's going to be all over but the shouting. Let me give you a quick example. When we were involved in the 20-week fetal pain ban in Georgia, a group of senators, five of them, hijacked the bill and wanted to add a definition for futile pregnancy in the bill. They wanted an exception. Now, in Georgia, we have no exceptions in any of our pro-life law. Let me say that again. We're one of two states in the nation who have successfully avoided compromising the very core policy objectives of the movement. No exceptions whatsoever in our legal code until these senators hijacked the bill. Four of the five were targeted politically and are no longer with us. What's the definition of a fetal pregnancy? It's a fetus is anencephalic, or a diagnosis of Potter syndrome, or a congenital or chromosomal anomaly is made that's incompatible with life. Now, I'm just a former drywall hanger, a businessman, successful businessman, but, you know, I had to put this into Google to find out where it came from. You know, that's the best and easiest way to trace down source material. And do you know what pulled up? The U.S. Holocaust Memorial. I went, what in the world is going on? I thought it came from the Georgia Medical Association or the American Medical Association. The language came straight out of Hoche and Binding's public policy article in Germany in the 1920s. Now, this is 13 years before Hitler comes to power. He's in jail writing Mein Kampf. This is not about Nazism. It's about public policy. And what they decided, let's look at it, the debate centered on the argument that economic savings justified the killing of useless eaters. 1920, years, decade before Nazism took over, the public was being groomed in through public policy dialogue to accept the unthinkable in a Christian German country. Catholicism and Lutheranism, side by side, very strong, very much alive, and debating the killing of useless eaters. We call this Germany's slippery slope. Potter syndrome, children born with anencephaly, nothing but a lower cortex. They didn't know it as trisomy then, but trisomy 16, 18, and 21, Down syndrome. These were futile pregnancies that Georgia wanted to have an exception for. First time in Georgia law that there's been a eugenic law introduced. Then in Germany, they added the incurably ill as medically futile. Then the blind, deaf, and dumb children. The mentally challenged, the insane asylums, the mental institutes were emptied, and then the elderly. But it didn't stop there. It went on to the half-breeds and the other undesirables, and of course it ended in the Holocaust itself. It's a slippery slope in public policy. And this quaint little village in Germany looked like this in the 1920s. And no, that is not the bodies of concentration camp victims being burned in their ovens or anything like that. This is, as I said, very early in the whole process. World War I had just concluded, and there was hyperinflation raging throughout Germany. The Weimar Republic was in shambles. Their finances were in shambles. It took a wheelbarrow of money to buy a loaf of bread, and they were burning the billion mark notes to heat their homes or wallpaper their walls against the cold. But they were also boarding up school buses, the windows of school buses, so that they could go around and collect these useless eaters. They were muffled from the cries and the screams. At first, they began just in the delivery area of the hospitals, collecting these children that were born with some form of fetal anomaly. But pretty soon, it expanded to the older children, blind, deaf, and dumb children, otherwise normal or healthy. And they were met at the door from these school buses by a welcoming staff of nurses. Six of these nurses were condemned in Nuremberg. The children were sent down this stairway into the basement of a hospital, Adamir Hospital, where they were told to go ahead and disrobe, and they were going to meet with a medical examiner who was going to label them with different color Band-Aids according to their need. He was going to assign a critical illness to each one of them on their paperwork. Here comes a little 8-year-old, and he puts acute appendicitis on the paperwork. And 4 months later, his parents receive an urn of ashes that their child has died of acute appendicitis with a death certificate. Not to be confused with the fact that the child had had its appendix out 3 years before. They were sent and told to disrobe so that they could shower before bed, and they were crammed into this room. Now, I want you to look at that window. Fix that in your mind, because that was the last thing these children saw, because the school buses backed up to the wall outside that window and piped exhaust fumes into the shower, 70 at a time, every other day. The Band-Aids were kill them, and remove their brain for research if they were a mental patient, or kill them and break out their gold teeth. 70 patients every other day. I saw the list. I saw the production. This was the proving ground for Auschwitz, Dachau, Buchenwald. This is where it began. They began proof of concept in this little quaint village of Hadamar. And there's the dissection room where they were eventually taken, some of them, or to the ovens. And this is all that's left of the two ovens that were side by side. Exact replicas of these ovens are now found in Auschwitz today. The blueprint was developed here. The killing was developed here early in the societal process. Look at little Anna. She died at 8 years old for no other reason than she had Down syndrome. Or Carl, who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, 7 years old. I mean, does anybody know a seven-year-old that's not schizophrenic? I mean, you see these other children for slow developmental, educational development would be confined to a mental institute for evaluation and at the whim of the psychiatrist put on a school bus and carried to Hadamar where they were never seen again. Or this little boy who was a bedwetter, and that was a physiological, psychological condition that condemned him to death. Or these children who were half-breeds, gypsies and Jews and Aryans together, whose only crime was their manner of conception. You know, we have that same debate and dialogue in our pro-life movement today. Georgia Right to Life, Personhood Alliance, we do not condemn a child to death legally because of its manner of conception. And that includes rape, incest, fetal anomaly, and a whole host of other things that are now being decided. How much further down this path do we need to go before it's time to reverse it? This little blind girl was thrown into the air to see how a blind girl would respond to free fall over and over again. And Baron, and I forget his last name, went for a treatment at a mental facility nearby and got on the wrong bus and was never seen again. 10,000 children by 1941, but the parents had wised up. The parents who'd received the urn of a child dying of appendicitis, acute appendicitis, went and they marched in the streets. Now, if you know your Holocaust history, Himmler, Goebbels, Hitler, the SS, the Gestapo, nothing could stop the outcry of Germany's parents. And it wasn't just Germany's parents. The bishops were speaking out. The pastors were, in a few cases, speaking out, but not nearly enough and not nearly soon enough to save the Holocaust, which by 1941 was well in along its way. Slippery slope, we have to answer in today's public square, when are we human? Because if human exceptionalism means anything, it's got to be based on humanity when we are human. So science tends to answer that question. Not anymore. I go down and I speak to the bioethics and stem cell research class at Georgia Institute of Technology once a year. I've been doing this for a number of years. The professor takes my previous year arguments, teaches his class how to debunk that argument, and then invites me in for a fresh round to see what's next. And I want to tell you, the classes are getting harder and harder. I don't mean that in the sense of more difficult. I mean their hearts are hardening. The reason we call it personhood is because that's when legal rights attach in America. That's when they attach in Germany. That's when they attach in the Netherlands and Israel and elsewhere. The ultimate goal of the pro-life movement is legal protection, effective legal protection. And that is what personhood is. It's a legal term, juridical personhood, which is the objective and always has been of the movement from its inception. Jack Wilkie was very clear in his recent book, Abortion and the Pro-Life Movement, that this is and has been the objective of the movement, but somewhere along the way, we abandoned it for a more pro-political avenue, and that means now pro-Republican. And I'm telling you, we have become the shill of the Republican Party. And it's time that we stood firm and refused the role of kingmaker for that of standard bearer. God is not going to say, were you successful with your political campaigns? He is going to say, did you stand faithfully for me and my word? Mother Teresa said it well, God's not called us to success. He's called us to faithfulness. And that is what we should be about as a movement. Now, I'm going to step into the controversial here. The H.R. 2036, 20-week pain-capable ban, had a rape and incest exception in it out of the chute that nobody knew about. None of us were informed. Nobody knew. And it was hidden very well by the powers that be within the movement. When we found out about it, we were incensed because obviously a deal was done. 2 years ago, it was not in the bill when it was introduced into Congress. It was a clean bill. No class of human life was selected for destruction legally. This year, it was a done deal, and it made pro-life history in a nefarious sort of way because everybody agreed to do this on the front end. Why? It was the greatest good for the greatest number. That is and always will be a math formula that reflects the concept and philosophy of utilitarianism. When we as a movement are infected with the very thing that Peter Singer is pushing as a philosophy, as an idea. Ideas have consequences, and we're seeing the consequences of these ideas year upon year upon year. I'm not going to, I've blacked out which of the groups, which you would know, you know absolutely this group, $9 million a year budget, pro-life. And this is what they said, and if you want to know who it is, you talk to this lady right here who provided it to me, Denise Leopold, Northeast Ohio Right to Life. I am so proud, as I've said before, of the groups here in Ohio who stood firm, who didn't accuse anybody, but went back and said, will you work with us, National Right to Life, Susan B. Anthony List, Father Frank Provone, Priest for Life, will you work with us to call for the Republican Party to remove this dastardly and deadly precedent out of the law? And this was the response. Therefore, H.R. 36, when it is only willed for the good that it will accomplish, which greatly outweighs the evil, 35,550 babies will be saved by this measure annually on average, and 250 babies will not be protected. Then one can enact this principle morally and ethically. In fact, it is immoral to not support the bill. Now, I point this out only in as much as it isn't even true. Those children, 250 babies, will not be protected. That's not true at all. Those 250 babies will be killed legally with the permission and blessing of the pro-life movement in order to accomplish a broader gain. Now, we encountered this in Georgia. All I can tell you is that in every state, Michigan, I wish you would have Barb Listing in here from Michigan. We followed our cue from her. They have no rape and incest exceptions in their law because they've stood firm. Every state that has tried this has succeeded. You have not because we asked not. We are kingmakers in the movement, not standard bearers, and that is wrong. That is wrong. I respectfully submit that the direction we're going in will not lead to where we want to be. Rebecca Kiesling back there in the back, Cardinal Dolan had an interview on the day of the supposed vote on H.R. 36. And in talking to her, he called the pain-capable bill preposterous and ridiculous. Now, I'm a Southern Baptist, so I'm not going to get into Catholic politics. I respect the office of the cardinal, but he said that to stab someone in the back while sleeping because they feel no pain, well, that's ridiculous. We agree. We agree. Pope Benedict XVI said that under traditional medical ethics, the guiding principle is do no harm. The contemporary bioethics abandons this in an effort to find the utilitarian goal of the greatest good for the greatest number. Under these principles, preserving the life of the human patient is not considered paramount. Utilitarianism, I'm just simply bringing forward illustrations that whenever there is a math formula involved, someone dies. This is not agricultural subsidies or roads and bridges that we're talking about. Someone lives and someone dies. Caiaphas used the same formula. What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Republicans will come and take away our place at the table. You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. Utilitarianism. We call that diabolical, condemning the Son of God to death, using the same dynamic. And where do we see our Lord's hand? See that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I tell you that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who's in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains? Now, note that. The mountains are not a safe place for sheep. I've been in Israel for a month in Qumran in these mountains on an archaeological dig, and I can tell you that those cliffs are vertical, they're rocky, they're treacherous, and there are no place for sheep. So why would you leave the 99, the bulk, in order to go in search for the one that went astray? It's so that we do not let one thing perish over another. I had the opportunity of sitting down with Peter Singer for lunch. It was at the Personhood Symposium, Beyond the Human, where they were promoting personhood for dolphins, as they have already done in India. You can't have a dolphin show in India because you can't hold a person in captivity and slavery. And he went down the list of his definition of who's a person. Well, you know, the problem with his list is who it leaves out. It leaves out the temporarily comatose, those that are misdiagnosed with, you know, a vegetative state, misdiagnosed with a persistent vegetative state. We had a legislator in Georgia, a Democrat, a pro-abort, who had a stroke, was unconscious for 10 days in a coma, and his wife was asked if they could have his organs. And he told the doctors in the committee hearing I was in, "Sir, I'm not usually with the pro-life crowd, but if you had gotten your way and I didn't have a God-fearing wife, I wouldn't be sitting here today." And he was right, because his personhood would have been revoked. He would have been a post-person. Alzheimer's patients, those with progressive stages of dementia, we see this more and more and more as people have testified here today. This is a reoccurring theme, and it is a wake-up call. Post-birth children, all the way through 18 months, even perfectly healthy, because they don't have the capacity to meet the criteria that Peter Singer has defined for personhood. This is the baby boomer bubble, 1948, 46 through 64. We have the largest demograph of our population coming through the system into our end of life years. Do you know how many of these baby boomers are going to die? All of them. Do you know when? Well, here is the projected chart of when that is. 77 million in the next 20-something years. 42 years of abortions, 58 to 60 million children dead, is going to be eclipsed if a utilitarian philosophy is applied to Obamacare against the elderly who now lack a personhood utility. In a utilitarian society, it's the greatest good for the greatest number. Leonard Peikoff said that the greatest good for the greatest number is one of the most vicious slogans ever foisted upon humanity. That was back in 1982. Talks about the ominous parallels between Germany in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and where we are today, beginning back in the 80s. This is a poster that is taken from Hadamer in their display center. And I want you to look at the left-hand column. This is the amount of gold that it costs every day to take care of one of the demographic blocks that are one person in these blocks. And the largest block in Nazi Germany at the time was not the half-breeds or the blind or the fetal anomalies or even the mentally incapacitated, which the middle one represents. It was the elderly. And there was a quaint old German man with a nice tie and nice suit walking around with a cane, and he was listed in this propaganda poster, shifting public opinion away from the elderly to where instead of having a right to die, and you can write this down and take it to the bank, the gays and lesbians have used it to justify their right to privacy, the right to privacy for abortion, the right to die. Everything evil begins as a right in the United States of America. It's based on our rights. And then it goes to a duty to die. We are moving right now from the right to die under the eugenic program to a duty to die. How many of you saw the Atlantic Magazine article back in November? The gentleman on the front cover said, "I hope I die before 75. And he was writing all of the reasons why anybody should not want to be alive after 75. Chilling, chilling that we are having this discussion at all. And yet what is happening is that our public media is shifting the right to die, which is a personal right, to a corporate duty to die. Now, I'm looking out in the audience. I see some of you that really ought to die, according to that. You're over 75. Can you imagine that we're having, once again, this dialogue and discussion? Well, I asked Peter Singer when I sat down at lunch, and I said to him, "Truly, surely, this is not you. This is just the myth that we pro-lifers have created around you." Because he's a really, charismatic individual, real self-effacing. He's a great personality, just gentle, humble, very winsome. And I was sure that we had had it wrong somewhere, and we were doing what they do to us. I asked him the question, "Aren't you afraid of the slippery slope that took place under your leadership of the Independent Payment Advisory Board? Even though you're not the head of it officially, Obama has appointed you as the spokesperson and the evangelist for this. the man who, for his doctorate or his master's degree thesis, wrote Why We Shouldn't Be Moral. We are in the hands of a very similar situation. Hoche and Binder and their public policy stance is being promoted successfully today, and it's being fed to us. And when I sit down with him and I said, you lost your own grandparents in the Holocaust, he said, no. The elderly, the infirm, we're doing it today. We're doing it already. We just need to codify it and make it fair to everybody. A duty to die to what we've seen in Netherlands. What's the next step? Involuntary death. A right to die to a duty to die to involuntary death. That's the process that the liberal left uses successfully. Why don't we do the same thing? We have a right to personhood. We have a right to protection under the law. So do the preborn. We're human, created in the image of God. We have a right, so we're out there preaching rights educationally. We move it into the political realm, and we show where the duty of the politicians is to protect life, as Jefferson said. The only duty is of a good law is to protect innocent human life, the duty of all government. What do they have in common? All life is not equal. It is just to take some human life for the greater good. Now, I'm saying when we as a movement fall into that same camp, we have crossed a line. And it needs to be said, and I'll gladly take the heat for that, but somebody needs to say that the emperor has no clothes. Otherwise, we face a certain judgment. Ideas have consequences. Do we have school buses in our future? These were the ovens at Hadamar. And this is a graphic picture next in line here. That was the oven at Hadamar. This is the oven at Wichita, Kansas, with an aborted child being thrown into the oven along with the cats and the dogs whose bodies were euthanized at the local pound. Can't happen here. Tell you, Jesus said, you're the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. What happened January 22nd? Our best efforts were trampled under the feet of the Republican leadership in the most Republican, and I know from headcount, the most pro-life house in our history. Something's wrong. Something's wrong. We need lighthouse keepers, and that's the challenge to you. And I'm going to give you and close with this story, and we'll open it up for a few questions, and tell you the story of Dr. Siegfried Ernst. He was a surgeon and a doctor in Germany in the 1940s, and he was ordered to go to Hadamar, Germany, and oversee the killing center in Hadamar. Dr. Ernst, being a good evangelical Lutheran, said, no, my faith informs my decisions. And he knew with the height of the Gestapo and the SS that they would come someday to his door. And he was not wrong. They came, picked him up in the middle of the night, and rather than take him to a concentration camp, he was a doctor. The greatest good for the greatest number demanded that his skills be put to use on the Russian front at the height of the Battle of Moscow. Now, any of you historians know it's the bloodiest battle in the history of the world. And just as the troops, like Uriah, in the Bible, Old Testament, the very tip of the spear that was circling around in a pincher movement to the top of Moscow, They never completed the pincher because the retreat was ordered by the German commanders before they could complete the encirclement of Moscow, and he, being at the tip of the spear, was left behind enemy lines. What do you do? What any Christian would do. He ministered to suffering and hurt by going into the local Russian village and being the doctor in that village, ministering the love of Christ to his enemies. Well, the troops withdrew completely back to a front line way below the city of Moscow. And he was left there in the Russian villages, working in their medical centers, until he earned the respect and the trust of the local people, who snuck him out one night through the front line back to his unit as they retreated all the way back to Berlin, and he survived the war. It was over not long after that. Dr. Siegfried Ernst, you might recognize Barbara and Jack Wilkie there. Dr. Siegfried Ernst became the leader in Germany of the pro-life movement. Do you know that Germany has some of the most critical and narrow bioethics laws of all Western countries in the world? In other words, they are much more restrictive on the taking of human life and human experimentation and research in Germany than any other Western country in the world. Do you know that the U.S. is right up there with China and North Korea as being the least regulated country in the world? Dr. Jack Wilkie met with Siegfried Ernst, who was responsible for those restrictive bioethical laws. One man standing up against the tide. Now, I told you to watch that church. The last thing seen through that arched window of 7 and 8 year old children was the courtyard of that church, not 70 yards away, the Sunday school wing. The sign on there, the symbol, is the Hospital of Hadamar. The basement faces the church. That arched window looks out across the courtyard, and there it is. And, of course, all they did was sing a little louder. We need to evaluate who and where we are today and what God is requiring of us. Now, you've heard the challenges from many of the speakers. I believe we're at the most pivotal time in our history. Martin Niemöller, in his address to canonize the facility at Hadamar so it would never be done again in Germany, was taken to a concentration camp for many years for his opposition. Three Catholic priests lost their life. They were beheaded by the SS, the ISIS of their day, when they distributed the bishop's encyclical against Hadamar. Niemöller spoke out against it, but not until late. First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, but I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. We are speaking for the most vulnerable in our midst. And we need to be that light, even if it's a dark time, because I don't believe the darkness will last forever. But this is our day. This is our time in history. This is what we will answer for. Will you be a light? in the darkness. Thank you so much.
We have time for just one question. Again, you'll be speaking tomorrow, and I'm following up because you spurred a lot of questions, but we'll take just one, I think, that we can answer briefly. When you write that Georgia Tech dealing with the people in the opposition, was there a go-to argument? Is there something that most of us feel overwhelmed when we get opposition? You're going right back again and again. How would you train us to handle that?
Okay. The go-to argument that we always fall back on is that we are not ashamed of our faith. We state that there is a faith-based reason, and that as long as there are Christians in the United States, there will be a pro-life movement and a movement for the sanctity of life. Now, what's their response? Well, do away with the Christians. I mean, that is all they're left with, because when you appeal to a faith-based argument, they have to attack your faith. They have to. And in America, the home of the land of the free and rights for everyone, for anything at all times, how dare they attack your right to a religious belief? So there's really no defense for that. And it puts them off their game. If I were to come at them with the philosophical or any of the economic arguments and so on and so forth, they've got arguments for all of that. But it comes down to, will we stand firm on being the salt in the culture? And it just takes a little. It doesn't take a lot. And I have had students come to me afterwards saying, thank you for reaffirming what I grew up with, because they sure don't hear it from their professors.
You have been listening to Dan Becker, president of Georgia Right to Life and the founder and president of the National Personhood Alliance.